Okay, I think most people have come in now, so I can start. Still a few stragglers. So, for this evening's Dhamma talk, there's a couple of themes I'm going to put together. The main theme is that our president's husband sent me by email a little clip of a debate between Sam Harris and Deepak Chopra and somebody else on ABC. And it was just so disappointing, and just people arguing with each other. And if you have debates like that on TV, they're just so dispiriting. There was no science there, there was no philosophy, there was no spirituality there that I could see. But it reminded me of the sort of arguments which people have in our world today, husbands and wives, politicians, and amateur philosophers, religions. Why the heck do we argue like that? And so I was going to address that, the conflict of arguments, and why that all those sort of great learning just makes people more stupid. And number two, I was going to combine that with what we mentioned earlier, an old story, which was in the most important section of the biggest newspaper in Thailand, which was mentioned by Cecile at the beginning, you know, the story of the container, not the contents, giving you a nice insight into where all these things come from. But on the whole talk is going to be on a subject which I call intellectual materialism. Because materialism is something which we always look at as stuff. Our houses, our stuff we put in our houses, our cars, our bank accounts, or our loans, or our debts, whatever it is you have. And all that sort of stuff is materialism. It takes such a huge part of our lives, trying to get by, trying to amass stuff, pay it off, get more stuff, and that's, you know, obsesses so big a percentage of our lives, trying to get by in the material world. And that's called just the ordinary materialism. And a Tibetan monk many years ago pointed out spiritual materialism, when people want to have attainments. And who's got the most meditation? How many hours do you meditate a week? Only half an hour, that's nothing. I do an hour a week. That's nothing. I do an hour a day. Only an hour a day. I do 3 hours a day. That's nothing. I do 25 hours a day. You know what it gets like. It's really ridiculous and stupid. You know, who's your teacher? Ajahn Brahm, he's nobody. My teacher's a Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama, my teacher's God. My teacher's bigger than God. It just goes really ridiculous sometimes, just, you know, what people actually say in spiritual materialism. But the point of this evening's talk is not those two types of materialism, intellectual materialism. Who's got the best idea? The best theory. The best explanation. Because in intellectual materialism, that is why we keep arguing who is right and who is wrong. That's called a sign of intellectual materialists. Because they're arguing from ideas, speculations, thoughts. And that's one of the reasons, for those of you who are really, really, really well-informed Buddhists, you know, one of the great sayings of the Buddha, he says, I don't argue with anybody. The world argues with me, but I don't argue with anybody. And that's a powerful statement. What do you mean the Buddha never argued with anyone? Didn't he present his teachings and stuff? Yeah, but it's not in the realm of intellectual materialism. Sometimes people mistake those teachings, and that is where that story of the container and the contents came from. To actually to inform those who haven't heard this before, it was mentioned at the Global Conference on Buddhism last August. It's also one of the big stories in my book, Good, Bad, Who Knows, otherwise known as Don't Worry, Be Trumpy in United States. Grumpy it should be, not Trumpy, that's just because of Donald Trump. But, and very, very popular, that was, again, got to number 3, it's down to number 20 now in Germany, but that's not bad on the bestseller list. But there's one of the stories in there came from an example. Many of you heard this before. If you have, please bear with me, because it fits into the talk. It was a story in Guantanamo Bay many years ago when a U.S. Marine was accused of taking a copy of the Holy Quran and flushing it down a toilet in front of one of the Muslim inmates there. That was the allegation. No one actually knows if it was true or not, but because of that, there were a lot of riots all over the world saying this is just offensive to one of the big religions in our world. And even in Australia, it hit the front pages of the newspapers. And it was one journalist from the Australian newspaper gave me a call. He began the telephone conversation by, "You Ajahn Brahm?" "Yes, good." "No, you are a leader in Buddhism in Australia. I was given your name by somebody else because I have been interviewing over the phone the leaders of all the major religions in Australia. And now I've come to you as a Buddhist representative asking all the same question. A very simple question. Please give me the answer because this is going to be in the article I'm writing for the Australian. And the question is, Ajahn Brahm, as a Buddhist leader, if someone took one of your holy books, a Buddhist holy books, and flushed it down your toilet, what would you do?" And without any hesitation, I told this gentleman, I didn't know, I said, "If someone took a Buddhist holy book and flushed it down my toilet, first thing I'd do is call the plumber." It's an old joke, but it's a good joke, because you're practical. First of all, you've got to use that toilet. If you've seen some of these Buddhist holy books, they're really thick. They'll take a long time to get it out of the pipes. And of course, I always remember this journalist bursting out laughing, because it was supposed to be a serious issue, and here was somebody having a joke. And it's so refreshing on the serious issues of life, people with a sense of humor and telling a joke. In that debate which I saw in the ABC, there's no jokes at all. People are just so serious. When they go serious, they get angry. When they get angry, they start fighting. And after fighting, they have a war. Have you ever seen extremists never laugh? If they learn how to laugh, they wouldn't be extremists anymore. That's why I really celebrate humor in religion and in politics too. It gives people a sense of perspective. And I'll bring this up maybe later, because intellectual materialism has got no heart in it. It's got no emotional content to it. And laughter is part of the emotional world, not the intellectual world. But anyway, so when I said that, he laughed, said it was the best answer he'd got from all the leaders of the religions. And I always remember that, because I always say that, you know, if you are a humble monk, you know, you must always let people know. What's the point of being humble if no one knows about it? Flaunt it, I say. Flaunt your humility as a monk. It's like another piece of advice I saw. You know, always be sincere, even if you don't mean it. It's a nice little sex humor. But anyway, going back to this, after laughing, I got serious, and this is where I said, "Look, sir, you can flush as many Buddhist holy books down as many toilets as you like. And you can blow up Buddha statues like they did in Afghanistan, those beautiful ancient Bamiyan statues. You can burn down temples. You can kill the monks and the nuns. You can do that. But I will never allow you to destroy Buddhism. I'll never allow you to flush peace, forgiveness, compassion, wisdom down any toilet." And he got the message. Because what are the books anyway? What is a Buddha statue for? What's a temple? What are the monks and nuns symbolizing? What are we here for? We are containers. The Buddha statue is a container. What does it mean? What does it convey? Peace, kindness, compassion, love. So you can destroy the Buddha statues, but don't destroy what they stand for. The peace, the kindness, the love, the compassion, the wisdom, the truth, the respect. So I said, I will never allow anybody to flush that down my toilet. And I made this great distinction between containers and contents. And unfortunately, people miss that. And all the great books in the world, we end up banging each other over the head with our holy book, instead of actually understanding, what is this actually saying here? What is its contents? What is the peace, the mercy, the love, the friendship, the respect? Because that is not an idea. That is an emotion, which is not the same as the ideas which people argue over. This is a problem. We mistake the ideas for the truth. We mistake the theories for the underlying emotional freedom which those theories are supposed to be pointing to. The old signposts are not the destination. I think I said this a couple of weeks ago, but because I'm going to the nuns' monastery tomorrow, you can actually check this out for yourself. That to make the point, if you go to the nuns' monastery tomorrow, I don't know if you can go down there now, because it used to be the old nuns' cottage. There's a public toilet in the nuns' cottage. Just on the outside, on the path as you go into their cottage, those people who have gone there for dine, on the path into the kitchen is the door on the left. It was a toilet, and because I'm not a nun, that I have to use that one. Otherwise, there's no monks' toilets over there, just nuns' toilets and lay people's, and so I have to go to the lay people's one. So when I asked them one day, I said, where's the toilet? And they pointed to this door of their door over there. You can see the sign, it says toilet. So I went over there and I pretended to urinate on the door. And they said, well, what are you doing, Ajahn Brahm? He said, that's a toilet. It's got the sign on there, toilet. You told me it was a toilet. So I'm I was only pretending, I didn't do such a thing. I was just making a point. It says toilet, but it's only the door. The sign says inside the door. And so actually, if you have these monasteries, it's much better to say, don't put toilet on the door, put toilet inside. So it stops all the confusion. The signs are not accurate. That was just a metaphor for why it is that we have these ideas and words, and what do? We urinate on them, metaphorically, instead of understanding what these words are there for in the first place. What do they contain? What do the ideas really contain? And that's whenever we have these debates, people miss that point. And they just argue over who's right, which idea is superior. Which signpost is the best painted, rather than seeing where these things point to. And that's a problem with when people argue. And why people argue is because behind intellectual materialism, just like spiritual materialism and the ordinary materialism, there's this thing called me, the I, which possesses these things. There's nothing wrong with material wealth as long as we share it rather than owning it. It's when we own it, it's mine, keep off. That is where they have the problem with materialism. As I think you all know. We all know there's enough to go around, but some people have so much more than others that other people have to starve. People live in huge houses when other people are homeless. People have so much money while other people have so much debts. I can see a solution. You know, I did read people were talking to me about the US lottery, apparently. Somebody won $2 or $5 billion. And I think there was an Australian lottery, the Powerball, someone $70 million Australian dollars. Was that correct? $70 million Australian dollars. And some of my disciples saying, Ajahn Brahm, you've got psychic powers. Couldn't you tell us? It was won by someone in Queensland. That's unfair. We come every week to support you. Can't you help us? And I said, look, if you won 70 million, if any of you, if I told you the lottery number, you won 70 million US dollars, I'd never see you here again. You'd be off on some world cruise, living in a big house, and I'd lose good friends. So no, I refuse to let you win all that money. And also the case is, you know what happens when people win so much money? It ruins their lives. And sociologists, psychologists, they've proven conclusively again and again and again, if you win all that money, too much money, you're going to have too much suffering. So I was trying to find out who won that 70 million in Queensland? Who won that 1.2 billion? Because I was going to write them a letter saying, I can help solve all your suffering. We've got a nuns' monastery which still needs a road. So any of you who've got too much money, we can help you. Still needs a road. Any of you go there tomorrow? If you're... Oh, Sunday to the nuns' monastery. If you go there Sunday to our big event, please do not clean your car on Saturday. Because it's a dirt road, it gets really, really dirty. So, all dirty cars going in, and it'll be much dirtier when they go out afterwards. That's why we're trying to get some money to build a road. But it's lessening people's greed and also lessening people's suffering, because too much causes too much suffering. The same as too much intelligence causes too much suffering. Too much of I possess my ideas. And I saw that on that debate. People just too smart for their own happiness. And it reminds me of a poem which I copied and wrote down in my first book, Open the Door of Your Heart. It's from Sung Po, the Chinese poet. Brilliant fellow. And he called it, On the Birth of My Son. And I know one of my friends here is just, his daughter has just given birth to a son, Luke. So this is my gift for Luke. On the birth of a son, said this Chinese poet, that most parents, this is roughly, not exactly what he said, most parents on the birth of a son want it to grow up to be intelligent and smart. But I, said the father, through intelligence, have wrecked my whole life. And I only hope my son ends up to be dumb and stupid. And then he can live a tranquil life, and in the end of his life can become a cabinet minister. Who aren't noted for their intelligence. And that was about 10 centuries ago. Absolutely perceptive and so accurate. Now, because that type of intelligence I'm talking about means we get so proud of our ideas. We own them. And if anybody tries to take away our ideas, our rightness, our correctness, it's just a big challenge to our ego. It's like hitting us in our brain when someone tries to prove we're wrong. And that is one of the problems. Even in the time of the Buddha, there's this old story which the Buddha said about these two men who went for a tour to look for some treasure. They heard that some neighborhood had been abandoned, famines or wars, and so these abandoned towns and cities, they might find something which was of use to them. And so they went to this abandoned area in India a long time ago, and there they found some, first of all, some hemp. Now, these reeds which you can make sort of cloth from. And so they both bundled up a big parcel and put it on their heads, as they used to do in those days, to carry it home. And on the journey home, they found some hemp cloth. And then one of the guys said, well, you know, I don't need the hemp, I've got hemp cloth, that's much better. So he threw away his hemp and took the hemp cloth. While the other guy said, oh, no, I've just already bundled this up, this is good enough for me, and carried on with his bundle of hemp. And then they got some cotton. And one of the guys, oh, no, I've been carrying this hemp for such a long time, this will do for me. While the other guy threw away the hemp cloth and got some cotton cloth. And then they found some silk cloth, and then they found some silver, and then they found some gold. And all the time, one of the guys says, oh no, I've carried this hemp for such a long time. But the other guy was always willing to change what he had for something better. The other guy was not. So when they got back to the village, one of the guys came back with this big bundle of gold, and they said he was very popular with his friends and family. While the other... The guy who just came with a bundle of hemp got chased outside the village, you stupid idiot. And the metaphor of that story is, why is it that people, even though they know they're wrong and they see a better idea, still carry on and cling to their old ideas and views? The reason is because they've held on to those views for such a long time. It forms our identity. It's who they are. It's who other people believe them to be. it becomes intellectual materialism, possessing one's ideas. That is why each one of you, you can't admit you're wrong. Because that's almost admitting that yourself was mistaken, giving up something you've held on for such a long time. It's just too difficult to do. So that is like tonight's joke. Because I got, you know, I did a talk 3 or 4 weeks ago, and there's not one joke in it. And I got all these complaints by email. So even the bad jokes, they say, but give us one joke. So this was a conference. And a conference on telecommunications over somewhere in Europe. And the French were hosting it. And so the French, a telecommunications expert, got on stage and said, "It is my great pride as a Frenchman to announce this new discovery. We were doing excavations under Paris, and we found ancient copper wires, which we never knew about before. It shows the great Republic of France were the innovators of telecommunications. We had copper wires underneath our city before anyone else." And the English, if you know the English, they will never be outdone by the French. So the English guy got up there and said, "Yes, I understand that." But he was lying, of course. He said, "But we have found out underneath the city of London, ancient bronze wires were found. We all know that bronze is more ancient than copper. The Bronze Age came a lot earlier. So no, England was the inventor of telecommunications." And of course, not to be outdone, the US. The US came and, just lying through their teeth, said, "Actually, under New York, we found really, really ancient iron wires going under. And they're a bit rusty, but they were iron. We all know the Iron Age came before the Bronze Age. So this must be predating anything in Europe. United States, we were the pioneers of telecommunications. We had iron wires under the city." And then the Indian representative came up and said, "We've just been doing some excavations under the ancient city of Benares, you know, in India. We didn't find any wires," which proves that India had wireless communication. Way before any of you. So that's a joke today. But the whole purpose of that is, why do we have to sort of be the best or be the one who's right? That is called intellectual materialism. And we won't give up an old idea for a better idea, because we've had this old idea for too long. Just like in religions. You know, religions, we have all these old ideas. Why can't we give up an old idea for a better idea? Why not? Buddhism allows that. Other ideas don't. They have what's called dogma. Buddhism doesn't have dogma. It's allowed to be changed if we find something better. Isn't that a wonderful idea? But it wasn't done that way in the past. Yeah, of course it wasn't done that way in the past, but does that make it right? Are all traditions absolutely correct? And of course, it's one of the things Kalama Sutta said, no, don't follow a thing just because it's tradition, because it's always been done that way. Use wisdom. If it works, if it's going to be conducive to peace, happiness, then do it that way. And sometimes being a monk is just so hard to go against some of these old traditions. Look, here we go to traditions. I couldn't understand why it was when I went into these Chinese temples in Singapore, Malaysia. I saw all these people putting all this incense in front of the Buddha statue. Have you seen that? And there's not two or three incense, whole bundles of incense. Huge numbers, smoking the place out, and before they put it in there, they would shake it. You seen that in Buddhist temples? Shaking the incense before they put it in? Actually, if you go to the temple in Maylands, you see that there. And I couldn't understand where they did that from, because in Thailand we never do that, we just plonk it in there. The same as in sort of other temples, they just plonk it in there. I thought, why? Where did that tradition come from? And then I used my brain, thought it out, and yeah, I understood, because in Asia, You are first brought to the temple, you know, as a young girl, a young boy, by your grandparents. Usually your grandma takes you to the temple for the first time in your life. So grandma takes you to the temple and shows you what to do. And you follow what grandma does. So grandma goes to the temple, she shakes the incense because she's got Parkinson's. And all the children think, oh yeah, that's what I'm supposed to do as well. So now even the young ones shake the incense before they put it in. And you ask them, what do they do that for? No one knows. That's why, it's just tradition, that's all. God, because grandma did it, must be right. Please be careful of that, because that is sometimes not true. So anyway, the nice thing about letting go is we also let go of intellectual materialism as well. Get a better idea, we can change it. You know, there's a big problem in Malaysia and Singapore some years ago, because there's a lot of Buddhists in those countries, and some of their children were being converted to being these born-again Christians. And the children had such filial piety, say for their granddad, that when he was dying, they'd wait till the last moment when he was weak, and they'd go into the hospital with the pastor to try and convert you know, their granddad to being a Christian. You know, they thought that if he was a Buddhist and he dies as a Buddhist, he's going to go to hell. But if he's a Christian, he'd go to heaven. So they were doing it out of love. But you know, the grandfather had been a Buddhist for years and he was just being hassled and harassed and badgered and he was sick. There's a big problem. But I found a solution. And I told everybody, because I go to Malaysia and Singapore a lot, like you know, and I told this to the old chief, Reverend Dr. K.C. Dharmananda, and many people now follow this. I said, look, if that is your case, you're old, sick, dying, and your child or grandchild comes in and tries to convert you, if you don't convert to being a Christian, they will keep hassling you and hassling you and hassling. It's not worth it, so convert. Just convert to being a Christian on your deathbed. Then they'll leave you alone and go out the room, then you can convert back again. That's called it's called skillful means. That's what a Buddhist does. And I thought that was very funny, and that really undermined the Christians. All right, they're not the real Christians, these are the ones who try and have that intellectual materialism. We're superior than you, we've got the best ideas. And of course, that is just, again, going to the containers. What is the contents? Anyone who doesn't just stop at the containers, doesn't just stop at the signpost, doesn't just stop at the ideas, but what are those ideas for? Like that debate between Deepak Chopra and Sam Harris, what are you debating that for? Are you just arguing that just to prove that, you know, that you can defeat another famous person in a debate on TV? Just for your sense of ego, your pride? What type of spirituality, philosophy or science is that? Is that what we'd study physics for, just to defeat other people in arguments? The reason I went into theoretical physics, I can find some truth, some essence and some meaning to the physical things of life. The reason you go become a monk is to find some deeper understanding of the emotional world. And you don't use these teachings just to argue with other people. That's why that Cecilia's husband, Jake, was saying, I wish you were there on that debate. Yeah, if I was there on the debate, I would say to Sam Harris, yeah, actually, you've got a point there, you know, that you're right, I'm wrong. Because we do that because in Buddhism we have this wonderful idea of compassion and bodhisattva. Because if I really said, you know, what I really know and proved Sam Harris wrong, he'd lose his career. He'd lose so much money, he would suffer so much. And we're not into making other people suffer as Buddhist monks. So we got what we call the bodhisattva idea. I sacrifice my own happiness to make other people happy. So if he really wants to be right that much, okay, you can be right. So you can be right, Sam. Why do you always have to be right? You know, it's much more fun being wrong. You know, being wrong is actually demeaning. People don't know its value in life. People always want to be right, but it's great being wrong. Imagine you have an argument with your partner, and straight away you admit you're wrong. She wouldn't know what to say next. She'd be so bamboozled, so shocked. She'd probably have to sit down and just take a pill. Imagine that. Imagine that Donald Trump told Obama, "I'm sorry, Barack Obama, I was wrong." That would be really newsworthy. That would get him more attention on the newsreels than saying he's right and everyone else is wrong. But isn't it wonderful to be allowed to be wrong? What's bad or what's wrong with being wrong? It doesn't really make sense, does it? What's wrong with being wrong? It's actually everything right with never. You don't always have to be correct. The reason is because that's not the meaning of life, having the best idea. Just like many people thought they have to be richest, have the most material things to be successful in life, to have arrived in life. And some people think they have to have the best ideas, to be able to argue with everybody else and prove everyone else wrong, to be the best in intellectual materialism. But that to me doesn't really matter at all. What's more important is to have that happiness, that respect, that love for one another. So instead of having respect for ideas, respect for a person. Instead of having this terrible conflict which comes when everybody thinks they're right, and they all fight to the death for their ideologies, and they're doing that right now, bombing people, killing people, just because of ideas. They've been doing that for centuries. Can't we do something better than that? Because that is intellectual materialism. It's not religion, it's intellectual materialism, ideas. And that just causes so much problems. So one way of overcoming that is you don't have to fight over ideologies. Go to the next level, to go to fight for the spiritual values, not with. And you can't do this with bombs or with guns or with fists. No, for things like respect, kindness, love. Because that's something which, you know, sometimes I find it hard to put into words. That's why we do have poets, because they are the best people who can put the emotions into some sort of language. And they can't do that without many, many words in a long poem, to actually to paint a picture, to point the signpost at so many different angles, actually to get this idea of what respect, what compassion truly is. Even like compassion, loving kindness. Buddhists are supposed to be compassionate. But to most Buddhists, it's only an idea. It's like a thought. They haven't really gone deep enough to find out what actually is this thing which we're supposed to be compassionate about. What actually is it? And for me, it's just sometimes gobsmacking to notice how many Buddhists in the world, they even chant whole suttas on compassion, but they don't understand what it is, and they argue with their wife on the way home. It's not compassion. Even the idea, which I was saying last week or the week before, people actually have this idea that Buddhist compassion is not compassion. What if the being does not want to be happy? If they don't want to be well, why are you putting your philosophy and ideas on other people? So these days I say, may all beings be happy and well, if you want to. But you don't have to. Don't worry, be grumpy. If you want to be grumpy, you're allowed to be grumpy. You don't have to be happy all the time. Because that is one of the greatest causes of stress in the modern world. Everybody is supposed to be happy. And if you're not happy, you're a failure. And they have all these books on happiness, on how to be happy. Why do you buy those things? Because you think if you're not happy, there's something wrong with you. They have all these books on self-improvement. That is telling you you're not good enough. I refuse to buy any books on self-improvement. And I encourage none of you to buy any self-improvement books. You're good enough. The author is telling you that something's wrong with you and they will fix it. That is so arrogant. So you don't need to be improved. You're good enough. Can you believe that? Or are you going to buy into the self-improvement movement and think you have to be better? Even these doctors, you're sick and they try and make you healthy again. What's wrong with being sick? Demand your right to be sick. Because a lot of sicknesses, like the sicknesses in kids, that's good for your health. If you don't allow a kid to be sick and get a few of these diseases when they're young, they don't build up their immune system. If you don't know what sickness is like, you don't know what health is like. If you haven't had your heart broken in a relationship, you don't know what love means. If you haven't had, like one person earlier, had one of your relations die really young, at only 16 years of age, if you haven't had those tragedies, you don't know how to value your relations. It's okay, leave it there. Let it go, who cares? So if you don't have these things, which we all say is wrong, something bad, something terrible has happened, a great mistake has happened in life, if we don't have these so-called mistakes in life, we'll never have any compassion and kindness and love. They're important, they're part of the fabric of life, and the world would not be the same. It would be much less without them, without the tragedies. The world would be less, and your life would have far less meaning. So they have a place in life. So which is why, when it gets to something like compassion, instead of having the words, instead of having the ideas, we take it deeper, we feel it. Have you ever been to a hospital and somebody is really sick in there and they get really even more sick when everyone is trying to make them feel better and they feel such a failure for not recovering? Has that ever happened to you? People go to your bedside when you've got some flu and say, are you feeling better today? And you lie, say, a little bit, when you're feeling much worse. Why do you lie? Because you don't want to upset people. They've come all this way to visit me, and if I really told them what I really felt like, that'd be such a downer for them, I'd be disappointing them. So you always tend to lie. I'm feeling a little bit better today, when you're not. So don't put the pressure on such people. It's okay to be sick. It's okay to be worse. It's okay to be grumpy. It's okay for your kids to fail at school. You encourage them, but it's not a big deal. It's okay to make mistakes in a relationship. It's okay to be late. It's okay to tell a bad joke, but very rarely do I do things like that. So, what real compassion is something you feel. Again, that story, opening the door of your heart with no strings attached, with no demands, with no expectations of what you find in another person or in yourself when you do open the door of your heart to life, the world as it is, no matter what the world ever does. Now you can see that that is painting a picture, not an idea, which goes far, far deeper. It's eliciting emotions in you, feelings, which those scientists who are on that panel, even Chopra, Deepak Chopra and Sam Harris, didn't have any really emotions I could admire. They had great ideas, great intellect. The way they could weave their words was incredible, impressive. But emotions, emotional sensitivity, happiness, peace, respect for one another, that I didn't see at all. And I was looking through a book, an old book of Buddhist Society of West Australia when we had our 30th anniversary of our Buddhist Society in Supreme Court Gardens. Had a picture of in Bodhinyana Monastery at our bell tower with the monks from New Norcia and the Bodhinyana monks. This was many years ago. There was old Abbot Placid, my mate, with this huge big smile on his face, and me with an equally big smile on the face. These Catholic monks in white and the Buddhist monks in brown, everyone smiling. I thought, what a beautiful photo that was, because the emotions of friendship and enjoying each other's company were so pronounced in there. That was pointing to something which you never saw in an argument between religions. It was pointing to something which was not intellectual materialism, but this real spiritual wealth of when we put aside our containers and went to the contents. All your ideas, all of your theories, the sort of things you argue with, why do you do that? The old story of two monks having an argument. Did the Buddha say that believing in reincarnation was important to be a Buddhist? Do you have to believe in reincarnation to be a Buddhist? And one monk said, of course you do. That's central to Buddhism. Ajahn Brahmadi always teaches that. If you don't believe in reincarnation, if you don't understand that, you basically you don't really understand much about Buddhism. Another monk said, no, you don't need to do that, because in Buddhism you're allowed to have an open mind. If like that Zen monk, they asked him, said, do you believe in reincarnation? And the Zen monk said, no. Why not? Because I haven't died yet. He said, this was his idea, okay. So you can't actually believe in things unless you experience them in the present moment. That's the only place you can really trust, present moment experience. Because I haven't died yet, who knows? So this argument, yes, you have to believe in reincarnation. No, you don't. And they couldn't settle the argument, so they went to the teacher, the Ajahn, the master. He said, this monk says, you know, that we have to believe in reincarnation. I say we don't. Who's right? We can't both be right. One of us must be wrong. And then, you know, please let us know. And the other said, yeah, you're right. You can't both be right. Yes, you're right. And that's all the monk would say. What he was doing there is stopping all this argument business. Who cares about those ideas? Isn't it more important that as two monks you respect each other? You're at peace with each other? You listen to each other? Two different aspects of the same thing. Neither is right, neither is wrong. But arguing, that was wrong. Missing the point, that was what's wrong. And too much time. Now you encounter people, they argue, they get out the text, they put this huge, almost like thesis in trying to prove something. And I thought, come on, you're missing the point. That's not what Buddhism is there for. That's intellectual materialism. All these theologians asking, what is it, how many angels can be on a pinhead, as they did in the Middle Ages. Apparently that was really true. They argued over that. It's crazy stuff. How about doing something a bit more important, like how to just hold a nice kid and give some a baby a bit of peace and quiet so it can actually be happy and loving a kid? Isn't that more important than what I'm saying? So when we actually understand the difference between intellectual materialism and spiritual truths, those are things which don't live in our head but which live in our heart. Yeah, we use the head to filter out the rubbish stuff. What's in the teachings are good. You do need the signs, especially to point to where the toilets are. Otherwise, you spend a long time trying to find your way. So the thoughts, the ideas are important. But we must not stop there on the containers. It's nice having Buddha statues around. They inspire a person if you know what they mean. It's nice having monks and nuns. They're great symbols of renunciation and simple lifestyle. Go against the material world. But this need much more than that. Need to the contents. What are these things pointing to? We say loving kindness. What is loving kindness? We talk about peace. And we fight wars over peace. What is peace? If we stop in the intellect, we stop in the science. Yeah, okay, what is this world made of? Atoms, quarks, and all these arguments over quantum theory or whatever it is, but is really that the meaning of life? Or is there something more important? You look up at the stars at night, and is that a supernova happening up there? Is that really as important as just being able to look at the stars at night and seeing their beauty and being inspired by how vast this universe is? And how small we are. That is something much more important than to worrying about where this universe came from. So when we go to things of the heart rather than things of the head, we go away from the intellectual materialism of our world, which has caused so many arguments, so many wars, so many divisions between people of different ideologies, political persuasions, religions, and part of religions. That is the problem. If we can go beyond that, those are containers to the contents. To be able to feel the peace, feel it and to know it as a personal experience, not a word. To be able to understand compassion, see it, and respect it and learn from it. If we can find that peace and happiness and kindness, which is why that we spend at least half an hour meditating, so you can become emotionally attuned to what's going on inside you, your feelings, your peace, your stillness. Those aren't sort of intellectual concepts. Those are experiences. The thoughts only just go around an object, they never penetrate to it. When you stop all that intellect and argument and become silent and just become still, then you can understand what intellectual materialism is and how in real spirituality we have no arguments. We just go right to the core of the matter. In that peace, in that kindness, in that smiling Abbot Placid, who passed away recently, and Ajahn Brahm. Totally different sides of the religious tracks, but great friends. That is what I mean about spiritual wealth, not intellectual materialism. If you have an argument, you're already wrong, just for the sake of arguing. Instead, we go much deeper, where all the arguments stop, where we feel rather than think, where we know rather than believe, where we can have peace, respect, truth, not as something which is just a sign on a door. We've gone through that door, so never more will we urinate on the door. We'll go to where the real toilet is. Thank you very much. Sadhu! Awesome! Very good. Okay, so let's see if we get some questions. Probably got one from Sam Harris. I'd be so lucky. Very good. And again, for those of you who don't know what the three sadhus mean, sadhu is the old Pali word, and the best translation is awesome. It is, it means awesome. From Malta, Netherlands and Lithuania. What is the best way to approach someone who is greedy, critical and defensive? Is don't approach them at all, just go the opposite direction. In other words, retreat. These people are evidently suffering, but it's been quite challenging to be around them and receive their tantrums, indeed. So if you can be away from them, marvellous. It's not a good idea to go into the cage with the lion, unless you're wearing protective clothing. So if they are greedy, critical and defensive, you have to be with them. Number one, this is what the Dalai Lama used to say. Don't get upset by them. Don't let them make you angry or hurt you. And you can always remember that you only have to put up with them for a few hours every day. They have to live with themselves 24 hours a day for the rest of their life. And that gives you compassion. If a person is greedy, critical, defensive, they're suffering that much, that should arouse compassion in you. Just the suffering inside of them. And if you want to try and help them at all, is again, don't pay any attention. If you can, ignore their greedy, critical and defensive behavior. And when they do something different, when they're kind, when they're generous, when they're open, that's when you should start really paying attention. And let them know that, you know, you're coming closer to them when they act like that. You're actually giving positive reinforcement to the sort of behavior you would like to encourage in them. The negative behavior, if you get upset, you're reinforcing their negative behavior. So try and just let the negative behavior go. Don't react to it. If you react, it's reinforcing it. But if you let that go, ignore it. But in the positive behavior, you say, oh, that's a very nice thing you said, thank you so much, it's very kind of you. That was such a wonderful, inspiring, generous act you did. You gave the cat a glass of milk, wonderful. Even the small things make much of, and then you're encouraging that person to change. From the Netherlands, is intellectual materialism persistent partly because of fear of change? Yes, because we built our whole culture in the West on intellectual materialism. And we give great rewards to the philosophers and the scientists and the professors in universities. Universities get grants, nuns and monasteries don't. You know, we have to just collect the money ourselves the best we possibly can. And of course, those sorts of people, they're the ones, the professors, the doctors, are the ones who appear on ABC. The monks and nuns don't, because we haven't got qualifications, degrees. But I've been a monk for 42 years. But that's not a qualification. Somebody who's actually done a degree in Buddhism, they're the ones who get interviewed, not the ones who actually live it. Interesting. So do you have any advice on how to address this when counselling people? Okay. Intellectual materials, I'm full of ideas, you're counselling a person. Again, when you're counselling a person, you're not just listening to their ideas, it's who you are, your body language, your emotional state. People pick up on that. If you're a kind person, they pick up on your kindness, and that's what they learn from you. If you're a peaceful person, they pick up on your peace. That's what they learn from you. If you respect another person, which is what counselors are very good at, they respect a person, they don't criticize them or put them down, at least they're not supposed to. You respect another person, that's what people get from the counseling session. They're respected, which means they learn how to respect themselves. So that's not intellectual materialism. So don't pay too much attention to the words which they say, but just what you give them back in terms of your emotional sensitivity. And maybe through osmosis, maybe through your example, they can pick up on that and actually change because they learn that from you. And lastly, how can we forgive someone who is wrong, like my roommate who always thinks he's right? Just let him be right. Let him be right so much that after a while he goes, hey, what's wrong with you? You know, why is it that old story that, you know, I won't go through it in totality, you know, the married couple, is it a chicken or is it a duck? And he eventually sort of gave in and said, okay, darling, it's a duck, even though it's a chicken, even though it went quack, quack. You know, it doesn't matter if it goes quack, quack. If it goes moo, and she says it's a chicken, okay. And that story, it's in the Open the Door of Your Heart. It's a very famous story. I said it here so many times. That just in the car park over there, the lady came up to me, a Malaysian girl, said, thank you for saving my marriage. That's the first word she said. And when they say things like that, hey, what did I do? I said, that story. Because my husband would never argue with me. After we were married, for the first 6 months, whenever there was something which, you know, I disagree with, he'd say, yes, darling, you're right. He would never argue with me. And after a while, I got so frustrated that I went up to my husband and said, look, husband, don't you really care about our marriage? Why aren't you contributing to our marriage? Or you say that I'm right all the time. And the husband just said two words to the wife, chicken, duck. And she remembered my story. And they hugged and they haven't had an argument since. What that was actually doing, being right is not important. Being in love is important. Being the person who is correct is not as important as the person who respects you, and you respect them. So this is the problem here. The person who has intellectual materialism and buys into intellectual materialism, they're the people who always have to be right. And being wrong is like, you know, their whole sense of being, what they're supposed to be in this world, is challenged so much to the core. So it's great to challenge that. It's great when you actually found out you've made a mistake, that you are wrong. What an amazing gift that is for you, to realize you can't trust in intellectual materialism. Just like, isn't it wonderful when you get divorced and you lose your house, when someone cheats you at business and you lose all of your money? It just shows you cannot trust materialism. Sometimes it happens. You know, people are wealthy, they invest in the stock market, or someone cheats them, they steal it, and you've lost it all. People in Waruna, in Savyalup, lost all their houses, no insurance. The materialism was not reliable. Intellectual materialism is not reliable. You make mistakes, you get it wrong. But the spiritual truths. You might lose your house, but you don't need to lose your friends and all the wonderful people who care about you. You may be wrong and get the answer wrong, get the philosophy wrong, but don't get the love wrong. Don't get the respect, the care wrong. And then you realize what it's really worth investing in this world. Not intellectual materialism, not in ordinary thing, stuff materialism, but in the spirituality. So that's how I'd answer there. How can you forgive someone who's wrong? Because forgiveness, then you are right. You are right in the sense of you're building up spiritual wealth by forgiving people. Forgiveness is your right to forgive, your freedom to forgive. It's a freedom which we should claim. We can, we will, and we feel so much better afterwards. You deserve the freedom of forgiving someone. Otherwise, you're entrapped, imprisoned by whatever they've done to you. Once you forgive them, you are free. Okay, anyway, anything from the audience? Wow. Okay, so it's almost 9 o'clock. Time to go now. So we'll pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. If you wish, you don't have to. This is a tradition, but we don't have to do this. Some people, why do we bow? And one of the reasons is because if you bow a lot, then it exercises your tummy muscles and you don't put on so much weight. It hasn't worked for me, but imagine what would happen if I didn't bow. I'd get even fatter.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.
Oh, you don't have to do that. You should do it to us and to you as well. You get bowed out. Okay, so don't put on weight, especially here on the weekend. Very good.